Thank you for listening to this audio recording from LimoPlanet 2020 Free the Future. The following talk was presented at LimoPlanet, the Free Software Foundation's annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology. For more information on LimoPlanet, visit limoplanet.org/conference. LimoPlanet is a live conference with speakers who often use visual slides in their presentations. We have only selected talks for this audio feed that do not overly rely on visuals, but if you would like to see a speaker's slides, they are available at media.limoplanet.org. LimoPlanet speakers do not represent the Free Software Foundation. As part of our mission to show how important free software is to everyone, we have speakers talking about their use of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take positions on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedoms of all computer users, LimoPlanet is made possible by thousands of individuals who, like you, donate what they can. To keep this work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss.
And it's my pleasure to introduce Mickey Metz. Mickey's a worker owner and many other things. I mean, really don't need any introduction because we all know her, as well as Keegan Rankin and Chris Thompson. And with that, I'll just hand it off. Please repeat the title of your talk.
Sure. Hi, everybody. We're here to talk about platform cooperativism, surveillance capitalism, predictive analysis, and you. What does it all mean? Why are all these things connected? Well, we hope through our short talk we can help you understand how we have come to the realization that platform cooperativism is one way to escape this giant surveillance machine and crushing technology that is bagging and tagging us around the planet. I'm a worker owner in a web development cooperative called Agaric. Chris is my partner. He is also a worker owner in Agaric. And Keegan Rankin is one of our students that has excelled and has now become a peer, and we teach each other things. So we're at the intersection of a mass movement to surveil everyone on the planet and track everything, every move, every thought, and predict what you're going to do. And platform cooperativism is a way to build platforms that are owned by the people who use them. Say Facebook is a platform, Google is a platform, Uber is a platform. We need to own our own platforms and manage them and contribute to them, build them together, and include our communities in what we need for our own community. Every community is a bit different, so we can't just have one big, you know, cookie cutter thing that fits everyone. That is why the platform cooperative movement encompasses the globe. It's a worldwide movement. It's we are in Boston right now, but my cooperative, Agaric, is spread around the world. We're in Boston, Denver, Minneapolis, Puebla, Mexico, Managua, Nicaragua, and we have a partner in Hamburg, Germany. So we are active in doing outreach about cooperative development and building things together. We have coalitions of tech cooperatives that we work with, that we collaborate to build tools, websites, and all kinds of things. In fact, the presentation right before us was about a radio station, which is really interesting because that's one of the things we're starting with our friends in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, at some point. So we would like to just start by giving a little lay of the land as to what we have learned, and would like to ask Chris to speak a little bit. I'm sorry, I would like to ask Keegan to speak a little bit.
Okay, great. I mean, so I guess one way that we usually start off our talks is just to acknowledge what it means now that we've entered what a lot of people call the age of information, or other people might call the age of surveillance capitalism. I think the age of information really points to the fact that we now live in a world where the control of power and wealth is sort of under ownership of people who are owners of all of the information. Using the phrase surveillance capitalism is a little bit different because it points more to, as opposed to just the fact that information is where the power is, but rather surveillance points more to the mechanisms by which corporations and governments are able to use that information on everyone so that they can basically exploit our information and behavior and take advantage of us. I guess borrowing a little bit from Glenn Greenwald, one thing we typically ask everyone, we're usually in a room full of people, and we'd ask, who here is comfortable, you know, with all of these people, with corporations having all of your information? And, you know, usually some people raise your hand. I don't know who here would raise their hands, but then we would say, okay, well, for anyone who did raise your hand, can you just, how about like in our chat, if you would raise your hand for that question, maybe in the IRC, just post, you know, information about your passwords, and, you know, just share like your bank account information with us, and, you know, just tell us everything about yourself. Yeah.
No one ever takes us up on that.
Yeah, we haven't had any takers. Now we can, I guess, move it more into our topic and start talking from the beginning what it means that this data is being collected. So I hand it over to Chris.
One second. If you have questions, just post them in the IRC. We're watching the channel, and we'll try and work your questions into what we're talking about. We'll also leave a little time at the end for questions. Hi, Chris. What's up?
Hello. First, I did see a couple of comments on sound breaking up a little bit. So, everybody okay? Looks like multiple people are having sound problems.
Connectivity issues.
We're good? Okay. All right. So, first of all, I just wanted to give credit to Shoshana Zuboff, whose book about
surveillance capitalism
has kind of brought up a lot of this discussion, and also illuminated a much larger and deeper problem than just targeted ads. In using various platforms, we're generating data streams. We're generating data streams that have just been taken by these platforms and used however they wish. Of course, there are things that we collectively have just been handing over, our likes and dislikes, and our documents and associations and all of these kinds of things. And, you know, thanks to Snowden, we know that the government is slurping up plenty of information about us as well, constantly. But the surveillance capitalists are also using many less, some less obvious tools to acquire information on our daily lives. You know, even if you're not, even if you're not using a smartphone, for example, you know, you're just using a cell phone, you can still, your location can still be easily triangulated from cell phone tower records. You know, if you are using a cell phone, even if you opt out of location history, your location is still being reported actively to Google many times a day. And even if it weren't your own device doing that, if you're, you know, the SSIDs of radios that are attached to Wi-Fi hotspots around you are being reported by other radios on our behalf. you know, if you use any sort of tethering with your phone, I would suggest using USB tethering rather than Wi-Fi tethering, because the, you know, with Wi-Fi tethering, once your radio's BSSID is known, then that can be used, and not just by Google. There are other networks. I think it's called Wiggly.net.
Yes,
Wiggly. That publishes the list of Wi-Fi access points, where they were found. You can search by BSSID and follow a person's hotspot usage around. But you know, those are a little outside of the capitalist purview there, but still that information is out there. You know, when you don't have a Facebook profile, for example, of course we all know, you know, Google and Facebook are integrated into a huge number of the websites that are out there, and they're following us around to those websites anyway if you're not using third-party tracker protection and so on. You know, you do have a profile at Facebook even without having signed up. You have a shadow profile. You know, Google managed to close the loop on their advertising by purchasing credit card data so that they can actually see that what advertisements they've been showing actually do lead to purchase histories. You know.
Sorry, thanks for that.
Yes, we're going to start the stream again because there is a problem with the audio. All right.
Great.
We're reloaded, ready to go.
Okay.
And you were saying.
Yeah. Yes, Bob, you can, you, depending on the device you're using, you can change your BSSID, but that's, you know, there are ways to protect yourself, of course.
But the average
nothing,
person wouldn't.
Yeah, and nothing is perfect because there are just too many fingers in out there. You know, beyond purchase history, loyalty programs, your online communications, all of these pieces of information are being collated by these platform capitalists to better understand us. And you know, they're the level of pervasiveness is just getting worse with things like the Ring doorbell systems. You know, the Ring program actively works with law enforcement, dictates to them what they should use in their press releases about the Ring doorbell, about the Ring neighborhood network. They speak directly with law enforcement, you know, helping them to define the narrative used to sell the Ring surveillance network. And if you look at, you know, how hard that they're pushing into these spaces with use of facial recognition, once that data is available, you know, that's a, I mean, you can't escape anywhere. Even if you do leave a phone at home and just walk around as a free person, you know. So, yeah, I mean, that's a somewhat limited view of the amount of collection that's going on. So I'll turn it back over to Keegan.
Yes.
And try to catch up with your questions.
I think it's one problem that all of this information is being collected in the first place and that it's all being aggregated. But really understanding like what's actually being done with it is a whole different part of it. And really one of the main purposes of collecting all this information is so that we can basically be better advertised to. And so just to take a moment to kind of take a step back and talk about advertisement and the purposes of advertisement. Noam Chomsky and Manufacturing Consent had sort of spoken to the origin of advertisement, and not altogether, or advertising is very old, but at least in mass media and in newspapers in Britain. And I guess one of the attitudes towards the end, in order to, for people who wanted these advertisements in newspapers, was basically that by putting these advertisements in the newspapers, it wasn't just that advertisers would, you know, have a nice place to sell their things and so people would see it, but more specifically, advertisers were given a platform to subsidize media and like these press companies. And unfortunately, one of the things that that did is it made it so that it was challenging for like radical press organizations or working class press organizations to compete in that market. And so what happened is that it made it a little bit easier for certain press organizations to succeed, because basically they were getting subsidized, and the organizations that were being subsidized were typically ones that had were sharing certain types of opinions in the papers. So it and I guess in order to make sure, you know, that people were actually in a sort of like buying mood, as Chomsky put it. So that is sort of the way that advertisement had, at least had been used in a way to direct attention from certain news sources to others and point to different occurrences in the world. But fast forward to now, where we live in a world with predictive analytics, and what does predictive analytics mean? Basically, we take all this information, and there are super powerful AI computers that are just running through all of it and trying to figure out specifically how it is that we behave in relationship with these computers that we're using. And by using that information and understanding our behavior at that specifically, it basically creates a tool for guiding our behavior very granularly. And so to each individual, not just, okay, we can like guide, you know, everyone's attention by making sure that only certain content is available, but trying to figure out what sort of content is going to make you tick, where they can put it, what time of day that content should be given to you. They know when it is that you're most likely to be experiencing addictive behaviors. They identify your addictions. They take advantage of your addictions, and then they reinforce your addictions. And so I think that for me is a really big part of why advertisement now feels particularly dangerous. And now I also think about how we can start to actually question, well, like, what is advertisement anymore? It's a sort of science that's constantly changing. And I guess one app that is really interesting to look at in this perspective actually is Pokemon Go. I don't know how many people know about the origins of Pokemon Go. I know a lot of people played it, but Pokemon Go is actually an experiment that was run by Google to try to make sure, like, try to figure out how can we guide groups of people from one place to another place. And really the objective in all of that is really, if we can get these people to go from their house, maybe go on a walk and end up next to Starbucks, maybe they'll buy some Starbucks now. And so it's, I guess the framework I'm trying to put advertisement in is like, how does it actually take our attention and guide it around and change our behavior and take advantage of us in these ways. So yeah, that's.
And I guess I would like to talk about, why is this dangerous? Why does that matter? I like coffee. No. I would enjoy a coffee on my walk, but there's since the days of Cambridge Analytica and things like that, we've now realized that our data is being sold in giant bags to pretty much anyone who wants to buy it. So here's a little scenario. Say you are a young woman working at a large corporation that happens to buy data, and you go home one night, and on the way home you stop at CVS or whatever and buy a pregnancy test. Well, chances are your corporation could and HR department could know about that before you even come into work in the morning by purchasing the information on where has Sarah been, you know, like in when she's not at work. And Sarah can be fired before anyone even knows if the pregnancy test is positive or negative. Just by doing that act, you put yourself in a dangerous place with your employer who does not want to support your pregnancy. So the other aspects are any analytics that are being used to measure your propensity for criminality. They have ways of funneling our data in with everyone else's data so that you can see what people are most interested in, what do they talk about, what words do they mention often, and how are these words and things related to other people, say criminals. Well, you might have a propensity for criminality if you happen to have a few phrases that are similar to what they've seen or what they've analyzed that criminals talk about. It's just unknown to you what they're going to be predicting on your analyzation. You may think you only talk about baby showers and like fun outings and picnics with your family, but you really don't know how they are funneling this through the analytics machine to pinpoint you or others. So who might this be used against? Well, it could be used against people who are falsely incarcerated. It could be used to track you through areas of your life that you may want to keep separate from your business life or your personal family life. There's a reason we have doors on our bathrooms. There's a reason we have locks on some doors. There are some things that we just do not do in front of people or public, not for public consumption. So that brings us back to the rise of facial recognition and the Amazon Ring doorbell. I know Chris spoke a little about that. I'd just like to say a little more just to add to what he said, that this system of Ring doorbells is being actively sold, or actively not sold, but given to police departments to do as they wish with it. So Amazon is not totally marketing directly to people to get a doorbell to keep you safe. They are marketing it to police departments by giving them like, here's 20 Ring doorbell systems, Newton Police Department, do with it as you wish. And from maps that they have with their neighborhood network, people can share videos from their doorbell to say, you walked by, but you look like a suspicious person because you don't live in that neighborhood. You're just happening to visit your friend at this time, but you don't know that you're being on all of these Ring doorbells. It seems like some departments are putting them strategically, like every 10 houses on each side of the street, so they have 24/7 coverage of an area. It is more and more like looking like an open air prison. So what could you do to get out of that? The first thing you can do is, if you notice your neighbors with a Ring doorbell system, you can educate them. There have been a few instances on the news where people have hacked the Ring system. And Ring is not the only system. There are other doorbell systems like Echo and Nest and Alexa and all kinds of helpful things to answer your door or see who's outside of your house. So if people are educated, they might take a second glance at maybe that's not protecting me. So there were a few news incidents of people hacking the systems and talking to their like 8-year-old children in their bedrooms through the nanny monitor, and saying things like, I'm Santa Claus, I'm your best friend, or actually threatening people in the middle of the night through their system, waking them up with like, hey, you, I see you. Terribly scary things, especially for, I know that the people in this audience are mostly technologists and developers, where you might go, oh yeah, I knew about that. But believe me, your neighbors who, you know, use a computer for different reasons than you do, like they may not have any clue and think it's like really a safety thing. So I'd like to just talk a little bit about the platform cooperativism movement again, and how this could be a way out. I'm not saying it is a way out. I'm saying I'm inviting everyone to look at platform.coop. We'll have a resource link up at the end of our talk so that you can go and see the vast amount of resources, videos, articles, and the things we've collected about this surveillance system that's upon us. So platform cooperativism was started at the New School about 5 years ago as a lecture called Digital Labor. And when I saw that online, I lived near New York, and I said, I need to go to that. I do digital labor. I'm a migrant digital worker. And so I went to the conference, and it amazed me at how many people there were that were aware that digital labor is a thing. And it's we're not getting paid for clicking on a like button, but someone is getting value from us even seeing a like button. As Chris was saying, you don't have to have a Facebook profile to have, I mean, you don't have to have actively engaged in building your own Facebook profile to have one. They build one on you based on information that they buy from data brokers. They have already have your profile up there and probably know more about you and your behaviors during the day than you do. They know that at 3 o'clock you need a break and would like a coffee, so they hope to get you near Starbucks. So platform cooperativism is a bunch of people around the globe from a lot of countries, all building platforms that they will share with each other to host their needed things, like a ride-sharing company for a certain neighborhood. These platforms can be as small or as large as you imagine. It doesn't have to be a huge platform with all kinds of bells and whistles. It can be simply a neighborhood thing where you're collecting, where you're getting people together to share rides or share babysitting duties or, you know, take care of your neighborhood park, etc. So I would suggest that you get involved in platform cooperativism, at least take a look at it and see what is there that you think you could do. Would anyone else like to speak about it, or do we have some questions from the chat?
There is a question, and it's kind of a multi-part question.
Oh, good. I like that.
What the best way to avoid data video that is captured from the neighborhood doorbell while we're walking or jogging in a road or street? Is there a way to protect our data from getting captured in their doorbell system? On the other hand, mostly they say it helps protect the community. And of course, that's how people are being convinced to give away their freedom, is by convincing them they need the security. Is there a Libre software solution to deploy so that the data captured is owned by the community in a decentralized way, so the community owns the data?
So you mean having a community Ring doorbell system or something like that? I don't think there's any way to hide from the data. I think it comes down to the person level, where there needs to be a way to educate the people who have these systems. And if they are educated and they're like, I don't care, I'm just getting your data. I'm not really sure what to do about it other than having some conversations together about what we can do about this. It's like a plague upon all of our neighborhoods. As I said, it's global. It's not just in America. So I think the best thing I've heard is to send a handwritten letter to the people who have a Ring doorbell and apprise them of the dangers and ask if they would be willing to maybe talk about it at a neighborhood meeting, and then bring it up at your next town hall neighborhood meeting.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't really a way to opt out from collection of your data in the public sphere. You know, we're being recorded everywhere, and they're about the only thing that exists in terms of maintaining privacy from automated surveillance is, what's it called, Dazzle?
CV Dazzle,
CV Dazzle. So it's essentially disguising yourself in plain view, making your features difficult to detect by face recognition algorithms. But you know, it's a race. It's a arms race of sorts. Yes. In that, you know, it may foil the AI now and not tomorrow. So, really, I think the best way to fight it is to support things like the Digital Fourth, and help communities to build laws that prohibit the use of facial recognition software and mass surveillance programs.
Yes, that's at warrantless.org. And the Digital Fourth is a group that protects, or we try to protect, your Fourth Amendment rights. And we're all kind of keeping on top of what is happening and what is being released. Of course, we can't know everything. But when a new technique like a Ring doorbell or a new product like a Ring doorbell comes out, that's something that is brought to the group. And that is where I got the advice to write a handwritten letter and mail it to the people across the street who have a Ring doorbell and let them have a little awareness about how it is affecting the neighbors. It may be keeping them safe, they might think, but it could be endangering other neighbors. So is there another question?
Yeah, we got a great one.
Oh, good.
It's how do we keep building stronger bridges between software freedom and the co-op movement?
Yes. How do we build stronger bridges between the co-op movement and free software?
So, I mean, I guess this is a big one for me. Like, this is, of course, what we're really trying to do. And I guess conceptually for me, both of these things have really common ground, which is sort of the idea of like taking control of our own personal freedoms and what's happening, what actually is the form of our community. Software plays a huge role in, and I guess all technology, I think, or there are a lot of technologies that play a huge role in influencing the shape of our social order and our interactions with other people. And I guess talking about like free software is really a great way to kind of take control of what's happening with your own data. And that's something that we really want to be involved in the cooperative movement and in platform cooperativism. Unfortunately, not everyone in the platform cooperative movement necessarily yet is fully aware of free software. And they're trying to build communities to strengthen everyone in the community. But unfortunately, they can't do that if they're using tools that are oppressing the people within the community.
So we all need to get in there, into the platform cooperativism movement, and let these wonderful people know that there are better solutions to the software they need than proprietary softwares. It's kind of like a world of zombies now, where people have been lured to sleep by, Google will know what we need and take care of us. Apple knows what we need for products, so we don't need to look inside of our computers and see what they're doing. They know what's good for us. We've actually heard people say that, and it's extremely disturbing. But if you can get, if you can come into the platform cooperative movement, there are resources on our site, links to join, like message boards, forums, and they have some events. They have a yearly event, which will be in Berlin in 2020. November 13th and 14th. It was in New York for the past 6 years. And this also doesn't mean that you can't start your own platform cooperative group or meeting, whether it be online or in person in your neighborhood, and start discussing these things. If you can't join, if you could connect with a Garrick or any of us and let us know the concerns or solutions you think you might have, That would be great. You know, you can join by proxy. Okay. I will bring it to them.
I also just wanted to add on to that question. One of the reasons why I think that free software and platform cooperativism are capable of synergizing with each other so well is that with free software, like a big part of free software is that freedom to be able to distribute, to redistribute things that you and alter things and redistribute them. It's about creative freedom and protecting the creative freedom of our own communities. And so if we're able to make a sort of tool that can be redistributed to other communities and other localities, that is a huge way of helping us to move away from having such centralized platforms that are connecting people on a mass scale, and hopefully start creating platforms that can be distributed to other communities and collaborated on remotely around the world, and just kind of small, like reduce the size of our public interactions with people.
Yes. Read one of the other questions.
I just wanted to mention quick that somebody was asking about community networks, and Keegan is working with Mass Mesh and might want to.
Yes, Mass Mesh. Quick.
Great. Yeah. So I am working with a community owned. We're trying to build a community owned network across Boston, but also create documentation that can be used anywhere else. Basically, it's and it's, I guess, a way for us to start being able to build our own networks so that we can run our own applications, like on our own, within our own networks in our own communities. And I guess the way we're trying to start out is by using our own networks to be able to share access to the internet. So that only one person might actually have to purchase their internet service plan. And then using that person's router and connection to the internet, we can use our own custom routers to share access to that internet, that singular internet connection. And so that's, I guess, the way these ideas connect is that our vision right at the start anyway is to form, to help communities start forming buying clubs, essentially. So that one, we can get community members more involved with each other on owning our own infrastructure. That's a huge first part of it. And then some of the great side effects are just reducing the cost of the internet for each individual within that network, and also trying to reduce our reliance on huge like internet service providers like Comcast and Xfinity. Like, we might still need to have that connection initially to their service, but hopefully we can reduce the amount to which people are relying on them. And hopefully eventually I would like to see them not in the picture at all.
Yes. Yeah. Next question.
Well, this is a combination of a couple of questions, like going to the solutions again, and how we, you know, how do we address these problems with people that are just, you know, blindly handing their data over to these systems? You know, I just wanted to basically say, like, that's probably a bigger part of the solution, is to work with people that you know to help them to understand the problems. I don't think that we can necessarily convince everybody to switch to Mastodon and to all of these alternative networks without really helping each other understand the issues at hand. The amount of information that's gathered about us is being used and to effectively determine how we feel and think and predict our actions. You know, predict when we're becoming less, aligned with one vendor versus another, or one movement versus another, you know, and even anonymized, quote unquote, data, you know, is not harmless at all. You know, you can take accumulations of data about, you know, various about people in various areas and still and still effectively target them for various reasons. You know, the bottom line is that, you know, there are the watchers and the watched, and those that are the watchers have very unequal power right now, given the knowledge that they are getting about us. Yeah, I guess that was kind of a rambly answer, but another question is there any outreach to those affected by the digital divide? And if so, what measures are taken to educate those who are stuck in poverty about the abuse of their privacy?
Okay, well, Keegan and I have been doing workshops where we help people get encryption on their phone, the Tor browser, and get off of Gmail to protect themselves, with a little bit of talking about all of what we've been going through here. And we've been doing them in Mexico because it seems people in Mexico are more hip to what's going on because they have lived in a repressive society all of their lives. People in America have not. This is all new to a lot of people. Like, what? What's going on? It's new to people that aren't of color, usually, or aren't in a poor, underserved neighborhood. So it's a whole new ball game for them. People in Mexico are very receptive to what they need to know and what they need to learn. They're hungry for it. So we're working with the Center for Global Justice in Mexico to make this workshop a template that any of us could use. And we could have a course or a class anywhere from, you know, a city next to us or in our own towns or around the globe somewhere. I'm just going to share the screen for a minute and put up our resources before we have to end this, so that people can go to our site and get the resources. First, I have to find the resources, which are right here. Yes, and we will, whoops. And our resource links are available and will be there for, let's see. We'll leave this, the site is up and you can contribute to any of the resources that you want to. And right now, of course, it's giving me a little trouble. But can we take another question while I'm doing this?
Where were we?
What do you teach to use instead of Gmail?
Oh, okay.
That's an easy one.
Yeah. So there are a couple of different, the question is, what do we teach to use instead of Gmail? There are a few different tools that we can use, but typically one of the easier tools to use that we recommend to people who don't have very much technical experience is ProtonMail, because it has just a very easy method of encrypting your emails. And there are some others as well. I guess the alternative to that is to use some other like email services from another server like May 1st or with Rise Up, or I guess what are some other ones that we would recommend?
Those are the main ones, yeah.
Okay, May 1st and Rise Up are trusted server hosts who are very, they work very hard to protect the information of everyone using their servers. And so combine that with tools like Thunderbird that work with Privacy Guard and Enigmail to be able to encrypt your email from your desktop application.
Okay, that's a good time.
Thank you, everybody.
Great. Yeah. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, guys. That was great.
couldn't get the slides.
Awesome. That's really funny.
Capital surreal. That's awesome.